It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few moments, are too many American boys being diagnosed with ADHD and given prescription medications?
First, we continue our look at the Wisconsin Film Festival running through next Friday in Madison. Today, some of the upcoming films.
The Dark Matter of Love tells the story of love and attachment through the eyes of a family in Oregon, Wisconsin. The Diaz family, father, mother, and daughter, doubles in size with the adoption of three orphans from Russia.
British director Sarah McCarthy tracks the family's struggle to integrate the new additions and to create attachments with children who only have known life in an orphanage.
A neuropsychologist enters the picture to help them out, and the documentary follows not only the family, but the science and the history of science, of love, family, and attachment. Here's a taste of the film from the trailer.
I've always wanted a sister, but she's gone through a ton of orphan stuff, and I've just gone through a regular only child life.
This tells us something about the importance of love in the development of a child's personality. Let's see whether or not these orphans of ours who have had no affection at all can learn to love.
The Dark Matter of Love is showing at the Wisconsin Film Festival this Sunday at 3:30 at UW-Madison's Union South. About one in seven boys in the United States will be diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or known as ADHD, and millions will use prescription medications to deal with that diagnosis.
There's been growing concern over the years that too many boys are taking those medications and that our society is pathologizing boyhood and putting kids at risk of side effects.
Ryan D'Agostino joins us now. He's articles editor for Esquire. His piece, The Drugging of the American Boy, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You start your piece by describing some of the unintentional and unfortunate side effects that ADHD medications can cause to the young boys who take them. Could you tell us what those are?
Yeah, they're scary, and some of them are rare and some of them are common. The common ones might include weight loss, trouble sleeping, headaches, but some of the more rare but existent side effects include more sort of psychotic symptoms, hearing voices, believing things that are not true. There've been reports of kids having paranoid feelings that there's bugs crawling on them. They develop facial tics, and these are, I think, not because of the prevalence of the diagnosis of the disorder and of the number of prescriptions that are being written, I thought that these were things that a lot of people probably didn't realize.
And that's your question. You wonder, with side effects like these, within unknowns such as what do these drugs do to the adolescent brain, you're wondering, why are so many boys on them? How many boys are taking drugs like these? And girls, but it's a majority of boys. But what are the numbers?
Well, so boys are more than twice as likely to be diagnosed as girls, diagnosed with ADHD, 15.1 to percent to less than 7%. So we're talking a total of about 6.4 million American children between the ages of 4 and 17. And two-thirds of those children currently are taking some sort of medication. Many more have taken it and stopped.
And these numbers seem to be steadily rising with each passing year.
That's what was the impetus for this whole thing. That's the question I went in with. What's going on? Because until about 1997, the rates for ADHD seemed to be pretty steady, around 3% of kids, and people seemed to think that was sort of, you know, made sense. And then starting in that year, the numbers began to increase 3% a year, and then a few years later they were increasing 5.5% a year, and then by 2013 we had 11% of school children with this disorder, and everyone on all sides of this sort of seemed to be very alarmed. So I went in with that question of, you know, what's going on. What I came out with was an understanding of a different. First of all, there's lots of explanations for why this might be happening. Everything from Well, starting in 1997, the pharmaceutical companies were allowed by the FDA to start marketing these drugs more directly to consumers. So, well, okay, that's interesting. But then people have all kinds of other explanations, everything from diet to video games, and they have varying levels of credence. But what everyone started, what I started hearing over and over again was, well, and of course, when the numbers get this high this quickly, you have a lot of misdiagnosis. And that just was staggering to me, because a misdiagnosis with any kind of psychiatric disorder, you know, it happens. But when you're talking about kids who are 5, 6, 7 years old, and a misdiagnosis might mean that they're put on a drug with such severe and serious and scary side effects, it really shocked me and scared me.
Why is it that it's boys in particular who tend to be the ones who are prescribed ADHD medications at such high rates compared to girls?
Well, I think if you just look at the symptoms of the disorder, it's things like, you know, not being able to sit still, and needing to run around, and impulsivity, and not being able to focus and concentrate and sit there and at your desk for 3 hours in a row reading a book very quietly. And, you know, as a former boy, you know, I sort of... You know, any boy can sort of identify with, you know, we all had trouble sitting, you know, not being able to sit in school. And so I think people do sort of ascribe it to the general tendency, but very real tendency, for boys to be more active. Interestingly, a lot of people think girls are underdiagnosed with ADHD because they don't show these symptoms of, you know, hyperactivity or running around. But again and again, I heard, well, but okay, we need to be a little more careful, because boys, if they're going to have these tendencies, and if they're sort of, everyone, you know, agrees that they do have more energy, and again, we're talking in such generalities, but in truth also, you know, we need to wait a little bit, be more patient, and make sure that this is not just boyhood. The most staggering study that I came across in my reporting was a study that was done in Canada. It was published in 2012, and they studied 1 million school children, which is like by far the, you know, the biggest study of its kind. And in Canada, the cutoff for starting a certain whatever grade of school you're in is December 31st. That's nationwide. So the kids in with December birthdays tend to be the youngest kids in the class. The kids with January birthdays tend to be the oldest kids in the class. Well, if you're born in December, you have a 30% higher chance of being diagnosed with ADHD than kids born in January. And boys were 41% more likely to be given some kind of prescription for ADHD medication if they were born in December versus January.
So does that suggest to you that these boys just haven't had a chance to develop, like the ones who were born in January?
Precisely. Yeah.
Is there another strand of this, too, the atmosphere of schools? Is there the extra pressure point put on here that parents want their kids to perform well in school, starting at a young age, so that they can be competitive later on, and also that schools want boys to perform well on tests, to sit still and to focus in and perform?
Certainly. You know, you have a lot of parents who have heard that these drugs work. And by the way, they do work. And they're not evil, and take great pains to say that, you know, if your child is diagnosed with ADHD by a very good doctor who takes the time to make the diagnosis, it's a pretty involved process. It can't be done in 10 minutes. Unfortunately, that's the problem. So many of them are done in 10 minutes. But if you're comfortable with the diagnosis and the medication is prescribed and it works, that's fine. The problem is the misdiagnosis. And so, yes, well, you start seeing parents who want the kids to be on the drugs because they do work, and maybe the test scores do go up, although that is, you know, widely debated about, you know, whether these drugs actually improve test scores. But, yeah, with things like No Child Left Behind and any educational law that hinges so much on test scores, which increasingly they do, you start to see this tendency to, you know, some scientists have argued that the federal government is inadvertently incentivizing diagnoses of ADHD, because often kids who have a diagnosis and a prescription, they get to take tests, they get more time, or sometimes their test scores don't even have to be counted in the overall average. So the more kids you have who have ADHD, the higher the overall scores for your district can be.
And what about doctors as far as they go? Are there incentives for doctors that you saw to prescribe ADHD medications?
Well, not so much incentives. Well, I guess there are, the cynicism is that, well, doctors are being urged by pharmaceutical companies to make more diagnoses, and that has to do with the sort of Bible of psychiatry, which is the DSM, which is this giant book that comes out every bunch of years that doctors use to figure out, to make diagnoses. And the definition of ADHD in that book sort of keeps getting broader, and the age limits in which a child can be diagnosed keep getting wider, adding millions of kids to sort of the pool that can officially be given this diagnosis. But the other issue that doctors are facing is not that they're bad people who want to put kids on drugs, but that they are just completely sort of crushed by the pressures of working within our mental health system and our general health system, where the average pediatrician visit is less than 10 minutes. And as everyone has been in a waiting room at a doctor's office, you can attest to that. Many doctors have stopped taking insurance because insurance doesn't reimburse doctors for putting in the time it takes to make a proper diagnosis, interviewing teachers, multiple interviews with the parents and the child, extensive observation over the course of like a couple of weeks where you can really say, yes, this child meets all the criteria. It's sort of impossible to make that diagnosis in 10 minutes, and yet that's what they get reimbursed for by the insurance companies.
We're talking right now to Ryan D'Agostino about his piece in Esquire called The Drugging of the American Boy, looking at ADHD prescription drugs and concerns that maybe too many boys are being medicated.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now about ADHD and concerns our guest has that the condition may be overdiagnosed and overtreated, especially for boys. Ryan D'Agostino is with us. His recent piece in Esquire is called The Drugging of the American Boy.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are we too quick on the draw when it comes to labeling kids with ADHD? Have you or maybe your child been diagnosed? Did you try medication? Did it make things better or worse? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go right to the phones now. Let's take a call from Darren in Hayward. Hi, Darren.
Hello.
What do you think?
It's something that you do hear more and more. Like the statistics are going up. My son was diagnosed with it. And his grades did improve, but he did lose a lot of weight. His sleep patterns were very, disrupted, and it's just something that is concerning. He swears by it, but should he, continue taking it?
So your son your son has said, yeah, this is working for me.
Mm-hmm. But the side effects were the weight loss and the sleep patterns.
All right. Well, thank you, Darren. Thank you for calling and sharing your family's experience with this. Ryan, what comes to mind when you hear that?
Well, those are very common side effects to these drugs that are, freely acknowledged by the companies who make them. And they might not sound so bad for you and me, if we were taking some sort of medication for something. But I think when it comes to a child and when you see your boy and he's losing weight and he can't sleep, it's an entirely different scenario. So I sort of hear that frustration, and he's saying, should he keep taking it? I mean, I can't give medical advice, but I can say that I think that every family should think about whether or not they have been, if a diagnosis has been made, that they feel confident in it. And that's a big if these days. I mean, I had the president of the American Psychological Association tell me, well, you have to, parents have to make sure they have a good doctor. Caveat emptor, not every doctor is a hero. And I thought, oh my God, it's up to the parents to make sure the doctors are doing their job. But if you have a diagnosis that you're confident in from a good doctor, then you have to say, well, do we feel like we've been presented with all the treatment options? And there's varying opinions about what are they. Is medication the first thing you should do, or is behavioral therapy the first thing you should do.
Yeah,
and
what do the stats say about behavioral therapy? That was interesting.
Yeah, so there was a giant landmark study of ADHD in 1999 that everyone, that was sort of the biggest of its kind, and it's been used ever since, the multimodal treatment of ADHD. And it was, the question was, what do you do, drugs, behavioral therapy, or both? And the conclusion was that the best thing is a combination of drugs and behavioral therapy, but that's pretty much no better than using drugs alone. And so the problem with that finding has been that ever since then, everyone from drug companies to advocacy groups to even doctors has said, well, look, this study says that drugs alone, you don't need to do behavioral therapy because that doesn't work any better than just using drugs. And the thing is that in recent years, there has been wide debate and doubt about that study. A lot of the doctors who participated in it are concerned that it's been misinterpreted and oversimplified. And new studies are actually showing that behavioral therapy by itself, and then if need be, combined with a low dose of medication, is actually far better. And the specialist I focus on in the article in Esquire is Howard Glasser, who's developed this approach called the Nurtured Heart, which, in sort of looking at what was out there, I found it to be very thorough. It was an unusual take on an old tradition of positive reinforcement. It's sort of a better version of that, but you have to find what's right for you. But I think that, yeah, that the willingness to try behavioral therapy should be really at the top of the list.
All right. Thanks a lot, Darren. And we go next to Tim. Tim joins us from Appleton. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good afternoon. First of all, thank you very much for the discussion. I have two questions and then just a quick comment. The first one I wanted to ask is, as far as the effects of ADHD in boys, is it something where they will have the same consistent, I don't know what you would call it, characteristic traits or, you know, the trouble of focus? Is that something that just stays consistent all the time, or can it go in and out? So, for example, you know, if a child is doing well in school and is able to focus and testing well and reading well, you know, in that 5 to 7 year old age, can ADHD be something that comes and goes? The second question quickly was, what would be the first steps you would do if, like, a teacher said they had some concerns or they just wanted to mention it? You know, obviously they're not going to make a diagnosis, but they mentioned to you. And then finally, just a quick comment. You know, I want to know, I'm curious to know if it relates at all to how much activity and some of the more creative curriculum in classes and schools have gone down, especially in our school.
All right,
district.
Gotcha, Tim. We'll see if we can get our guest to answer those quickly. We've got lots of other folks waiting to talk, too. But, Ryan, could you quickly go through those?
Yeah, quickly. I think the question, does it come and go? I think that's what makes it so hard, as with any psychiatric disorder. There is a lot of subjectivity involved in the diagnosis. So that's why you need an extended observation and not a doctor looking at the child for 10 minutes. And if that's a rough 10 minutes and if the kid is bouncing off the walls, well, you know, that's no way to make a diagnosis. So I think you need to really get with a good pediatrician or child psychiatrist who can answer that question. The second part, what if a teacher...
Yeah, what's the first thing to do if a teacher mentions maybe there's a concern there?
Take it seriously and go to your doctor. I mean, teachers can't make diagnoses, but they see the kid, you know, all day in many different scenarios. So take it seriously and go see a doctor that you trust.
And then finally, physical activity. Does it make a difference?
Oh, big time. You have these schools where, you know, whether it's budget cuts or whatever, usually that's what it is. There's no gym, there's no recess, art classes are diminished. I mean, that's not how kids are made, boys or girls, especially boys. They're not made to sort of sit behind a desk, you know, for 5 to 6 hours a day, you know, quietly listening to the teacher talk and flipping the pages in a book. I mean, I've heard some schools starting the day with recess, which I think is genius.
Ryan, we've got about a minute left, but could you speak a bit before we go about what we know about drugs on developing minds, young children? What do we know about that so far?
Well, we know that the mind does continue to develop longer than I think the fields of psychiatry and psychology have thought for a long time, that the mind is developing deep into the 20s. So that uh, this notion that this is only really an issue for when kids are 4 and 5 and 6 years old, but by the time they're 15, you know, they can handle it. So that's a notion that's being disabused. But the problem is that the answer to that question is really unknown, because there just hasn't been – Ritalin's been around since the 50s, but the studies have just haven't been done because there haven't been the numbers of kids, and for a long time no one did sort of study why it was or what the effects were over time. So,
and we're going to have to leave it there. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. Obviously a lot to talk about there, and you can read his entire piece on the Central Time Facebook page, Ryan D'Agostino, the author of The Drugging of the American Boy.
Coming up, it's Food Friday, a plea for more attention to the humble lunch. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 3:07, and you're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll feature selections from the Wisconsin Film Festival. We'll hear from one University of Wisconsin alum about his new film, Memphis.
First, for most of us, lunch is kind of a sidebar meal, something we cram into a lunchbox or grab on the go between meetings.
But award-winning chef Gail Gann says with a little effort, lunch can be made into something that's both delicious and nutrition. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we asked her why she believes we should give lunch more respect.
You know, I think lunch really is sort of the, you know, the lost stepchild of all the meal periods. But what I love about lunch is it's really an important meal for how the rest of your day goes. Not only that, but if you're having people over for lunch, it's a lot less daunting. I call dinner parties the daunting dinner party because they, you know, they go on for 4 hours and it's expensive and people don't leave and they drink too much. But if you have people over in the midday for lunch, you know, it's like an hour, hour and a half. It's a lot more casual, sort of less stress. You know, less service is expected from you. Again, people aren't drinking as much. And it really, I think, can impact the rest of your day. And it's not just having people over for lunch, but it's also like packing better lunches for yourself, packing better lunches for your kids, maybe going on a picnic as a way to get together with friends, you know, as opposed to going out to dinner to a restaurant. So there's a lot of flexibility in that period, that meal period that I think we're missing up until now.
Well, let's key in on that packed lunch. My work lunch is an afterthought. It's usually leftovers or a sandwich, or I run out and get something at the grocery store or sub shop. Why should we put more thought into that working lunch?
Thus my point, the neglected stepchild. See, you're selling
well,
that
I'm living
idea
it,
right
yeah.
there. Well, part of it is, I mean, you know, your work day is when you want to be the most sharp, the most productive, and to kind of just, you know, not fuel your body for the kind of challenging work you're about to do doesn't make sense to me. And the way, actually, that I wrote the book, along with each recipe, is there's three different categories. There's how to pack it to go and what to pack it with to go. There's what to do to eat it at home with, and there's what to do to make it a party. So they're all recipes that you could pack to go with something else to make a lunch or eat at home with a little more, you know, you got a little more work than you can put into it. Or if you want to make it a big party and a gathering, what other recipe to put with it to make it into a party.
Now, on your crusade to promote lunch and nutrition, you actually went to the White House and you got to speak with First Lady Michelle Obama about nutrition and children's lunches. What did you have to say, and what is her thinking about why lunches matter for kids?
Well, that was sort of the catalyst for the book initially. I was part of the Chef That God Called into Action for the Chef's Move to School initiative, and it was as my son was starting high school. So 3.5 years ago, I got to go to the White House. I got to hear Michelle Obama speak inspirationally about the importance of lunch, the importance of improving lunches for our school children, and she asked for my help. And I gave it to her as much as I possibly could. I also, you know, have restaurants and kids of my own and write cookbooks and do television. But what I did was I signed on to mentor my son's high school and the lunch program there. Which meant two things. I could actually help improve the lunch program at his school, but I could spy on him at the same time, but he couldn't actually nail me for it. But there was this idea to me, you know, kids have a coach, they have a music teacher, you know, they're like, oh, there's my anthropology teacher, but they don't have a chef. And I thought these kids should have someone that they look at walking through the halls in a chef coat that they call their chef, that they feel that some of their relationship with food has to do with that person. So I wanted to be that person in the school. I kind of took a multi-pronged approach. I went through the PTO to help educate parents about easier, better, healthier lunches they might pack for their kids. So I like went to PTO meetings and did cooking demonstrations. I got in the school newsletter with suggestions of menus and, you know, a recipe or two every month. Then I went into the cafeteria, did cooking demonstrations with kids and had them try things they maybe never had before, had them make stuff with me, and then I got into the classroom. So I got into a physics class, got into a French class and did a demo and used food as a way to teach language, food as a way to teach physics, and then also went into the lunchroom and worked with the lunch lady to get, you know, Fryer Free Friday and things like that. So that was sort of my initial focus on lunch, was through the White House and Michelle Obama's program. And then I realized, like, lunch needs help, and I'm here to help. I'm going to save lunch single-handedly.
Well, what are some of the winners after this experience in the schools in particular? What are some of the successful lunches that were healthy and that kids didn't just throw away?
Well, you know, some of the easy things that parents can do, not only for themselves but for their kids, like everyone eats hummus right now, I think. It's a pretty common, you know, dipping food that you can either go, you know, for veg for dip or go with pita. But I do a pea hummus. So instead of using chickpeas, I use green peas, which are inexpensive, easy to get. It's from frozen peas, but it's the same sort of olive oil, garlic, salt, and pepper. I do a little bit of fresh mint. It stays green forever, so it's not like guacamole where it, you know, goes brown after you've snuck a fingerful of it. And it travels really well. So that's a great, you know, and you could smear it on a roast beef sandwich as well. So it can be a topping. It can be a dip. It can't be a milkshake, but almost anything else.
So you get some veggies in there. Yeah. What is your go-to lunch when you've got a hectic day, you're doing a lot of things, and you do want to nourish yourself? What is something that you cook from your cookbook that really helps you feel supported?
Well, those are two separate questions. I was like, cold fried chicken. Oh, wait, not, that's not that healthy. And then you rephrased it to something from my cookbook. So I'm going to flip through the entrees right now. I've got, you know, simple, oh, this is one of my favorites, the chicken drumsticks with chili sauce. So it's kind of like a buffalo wing, but they're drumsticks. So they've got, you know, a lot of flavor to them, but it's, you know, it's kind of like a dip and roast, easy to prepare the night before. You don't even need silverware. You know, it's something that kids would eat. They can, you know, pick it up with their hands. So the chicken drumsticks with chili sauce, obvious accompaniment would be celery sticks with blue cheese vinaigrette. But I also do, there's a loaded baked potato salad in here that might go really nicely with that.
And you hit, you used a key phrase there, I think, make the night before. What gets me on my lunch as an afterthought thing is if I'm getting ready for work in the morning, I'm not going to take the time then to prepare the lunch. We have to think ahead.
Right. So much of this is about do ahead, what steps can be done ahead. And, you know, that's where my chefing is less important and the fact that I'm a mother becomes really important because I don't have time. I don't have time to even finish a recipe from start to finish. So the idea of being able to do steps ahead of time really makes the difference between my kids getting something interesting for lunch and getting something boring.
Gail, have you seen all these books out recently saying Italian kids eat best or French kids eat best and they really know how to do it and they cook homemade food in France or Italy or fill a name of country here that's better than the United States? And one of the things I think that's so hard is what you and Rob were just talking about is finding any time, let alone, you know, the night ahead. That's one thing. But how do we find time in our lives to cook all these things, let alone lunch, which is right now, I guess, sort of our grab-and-go meal? How do we make time during our lives?
I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One is, you know, a little bit of planning so that the thing you're making the night before can then morph into something else for lunch. I did an article in a Chicago magazine that talked about, like, here's a pork shoulder that you can braise all day, you know, or braise in the late afternoon for dinner, and then here's the pulled pork sandwich for the next day that comes out of that. So sort of cooking something that becomes two meals. It's dinner that night, and the leftovers morph into this. And then there's also stuff that's super simple, like one of the pastas I do. It's basically a fresh pasta. You're cutting up fresh cherry tomatoes, fresh garlic. You're tossing it with your pasta, some olive oil, some mozzarella, like fresh mozzarella cheese, and it's a room temperature pasta with some torn basil. But as the flavors sort of sit in your lunchbox for the 2 or 3 hours till you've got, you know, till you eat it, these flavors like marry and meld together and just create a beautiful balance. So there's sort of two versions of that. One is, you know, actual do ahead, and some is just simpler stuff.
I like that idea of planning a dinner, but planning to repurpose it like you did with the pork sandwich there.
That's the perfect way to call it. Repurposing is a great way. Like I do these panko crusted chicken strips. It's literally chicken breasts that I'm, you know, rolling in like egg, dipping in egg, rolling in panko crust, browning them, and then the next day they make like a killer taco for you to bring in your lunch.
It does sound good. Robin,
so
I've been
like
cooked up with that.
Yeah. And so this is what my kids eat. You know, and part of it was just going through schools. I used to sneak into my son's school and like, oh, he forgot his gloves, so I have to deliver them. And I was like the culinary cop that would walk up and down the lunch tables to see what parents were packing for their kids. And I always left really sad. Hmm. Like I just felt like there was so much prepackaged stuff that parents were just tossing in a lunchbox. And I thought, that doesn't say you love them. You know, they need to know you love them. You need to make them like something real. So I kind of got on the crusade then even.
One of the recipes that you sent us is a Parmesan-crusted tilapia. Mm-hmm. Could you talk us through that recipe?
Sure. Let me just, I'm going to flip to it in my book. So it's got a nice fresh salsa on top, a cucumber, tomato, and fennel relish. Fennel is one of my favorite vegetables to use, ironically, because I lost on Iron Chef and my secret ingredient was fennel. So you'd think it would be a four-letter word in our house. But I just find it brings a lot of sort of crunch and texture. It's almost like celery, but, you know, but wound up a little bit because it's got that anise flavor. So for the fish, it's very similar to the chicken I was talking about. And I love using tilapia because it's a very, you know, it's a resilient fish. It's not delicate. You don't have to be careful when you flip it that it might fall apart. It stays together. It's probably one of the more meaty fish that there are, but it's cheap. You know, it can be farm-raised, so there's no issues in terms of environmentally. And basically, I mix up an egg, dip it in that, and then I've got panko crumbs that I mix with Parmesan cheese, some chopped flat-leaf parsley, salt and pepper. And I'm just basically sautéing that on two sides. And then I do this relish ahead of time of cucumber, some tomato, fennel, some scallion, and some orange sections. So it's got like sort of salt and sweet going on at the same time, like savory and sweet, almost like sweet and sour. Then there's a little bit of vinegar and olive oil, salt and pepper, and some rough chopped basil on top of it. So super colorful. You know, think about, you got the orange, the pop of the red tomato, a bunch of green. So it's a lot of fresh, it's a lot of textural stuff satisfying you.
Sounds,
it's a great dish.
Sounds better than any lunch I've had this week. Well, we're out of time. Gail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Love talking to you guys. Hope you enjoy lunch.
We will try.
Thank you.
Even if I didn't make it. Okay, bye.
Thanks.
That was Gail Gann, Chicago-based chef, cookbook author, television personality, and winner of the 2001 James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Pastry Chef. She's the author of Gail Gann's Lunch, out at the end of this month.
And we talked to her before lunch earlier this week. By the way, you can find her recipe for Parmesan tilapia on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Yesterday marked the beginning of the Wisconsin Film Festival, and throughout the show today, we're featuring films that are screening at this year's festival.
Here with us now in the studio is director and UW-Madison alum Tim Sutton. He's back in Madison for the screening of his film Memphis, tonight at the Sundance Cinema at 9. It's his second feature film, his first being Pavilion.
The film tells the story of a recording artist returned to Memphis after a recent success and a struggle charting a path forward in light of his newfound fame. The film has been called digressive and daringly experimental. It incorporates elements of documentary as it portrays authentic scenes from working-class Memphis. Here's a clip.
I'd just be wondering, you know, who really is my friends, you know? Seems like every time I come around and look for one of them, it always something happened to me. You know, I'd be wondering if they try to sit me up, get rid of me or what, but you know, it's gonna be hard. They've been knocking little chunks off me, but I ain't gonna lay down. You know, I'm not laying down for nothing in the world to tell the man upstairs or call me, you know? Yeah.
The film was funded with a grant from the Venice Biennale and was an official selection at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Tim, welcome to the show and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Well, we heard there the protagonist of Memphis. He's dealing with success and the struggles that follow it. What do you do once you've achieved what you want? How does he grapple with that question through Memphis?
Well, the story is about an artist who no longer knows how to communicate. And for what reason, we're not sure, whether it's the success that's hurt him, whether it's fear, whether it's psychosis, whether it's drugs, or a combination of all these things. And the thing that he's, music means more than the commercial world to him, or the spiritual world for him. So the church wants him to sing. The record producer wants him to sing. Everybody wants him to sing, except to him, music is something else. It's something that is inherently a part of his struggle, his life, his exploration. And so he can't just do that on demand. The more they demand it, the less he can do it, and the more he becomes insane.
Well, the lead in the film is a singer himself in real life, Willis Earl Beale, and he has an incredible voice that you put to use in the film. I want to give our listeners a taste of that.
I know there's a time when one day she'll come running back. She'll come running by.
Ooh, gorgeous voice. Yeah. Did you have a vision for how you wanted to use it in this?
Well, Willis is, you know, a true outsider artist. People think because he's black and he's from Chicago that he's a blues singer. And the thing about Willis is he's a real, he's a true artist. And he is raw and completely talented on a level that you get by being born, not necessarily by being taught or developing. And so I knew I wanted this story, kind of like the city of Memphis itself, this raw, beautiful thing that some people don't understand. Willis was a real metaphor for that one as soon as I met him, and he was this character, and he fit right into the city. And so I knew I wanted him to be creating stuff on, you know, on site. We gave him a little tape recorder, a little Casio, and like Willis is not a guitar virtuoso, but he is a musical genius. And so the more time he spent around set and driving around Memphis and sitting in the spaces, the more he would create these really intoxicating, you know, lullabies in a way. And so I knew as soon as he started doing that we would use that throughout the soundtrack.
You touched on this a bit. Let's talk more about the role of the city of Memphis as a character. It's the title, obviously. I've seen people describing the film as feeling more like documentary in some ways than anything. Why Memphis? What drew you there?
Well, I wanted to tell a story of an African-American singer who it, at the height of his powers, is going crazy and losing it. And I also wanted to create a kind of folktale, an American folktale. And to me, the northern tip of the Delta, you know, where Elvis sang, where Martin Luther King was killed, where all this great, rich American music was created and then almost forgotten, that was the city to me that had so much to offer. And again, like Memphis is a city of churches and it's a city of trees and it's this great spirituality. And at the same time, it's completely, it's cursed, you know? And so I wanted to bring Memphis into light from a regular point of view, an outsider's point of view, but not try and adorn it with anything, not try and do Beale Street, but go to the outskirts and let Memphis kind of, and Memphians who populate the movie, be who they are. Because I think there's a magic to that city and to the people who live there.
There's a review in Variety, I think, that says the film is challenging because it does feel maybe digressive and
yeah,
experimental.
A lot of other things, right?
A lot of other things. And people are, you know, maybe challenged about, is it a documentary? As you said, you went almost like cinema verite. It's
right.
Really happening in real time.
Right.
why is it challenging to people here?
Well, I think we're also, as a media-going culture, are now expecting a certain genre and a certain formula. We look for, we have a certain shot put in front of us, and we expect the reverse shot to then follow up. What I'm interested in is letting things develop and letting things move at their own pace, not necessarily at the pace that movies are supposed to move at. And so when a critic says it demands a viewer's patience, well, you know, that's okay, because the person who's going to give it their patience is going to get more than a movie. They're going to get an experience that is something bigger and at the same time something that they can really take the time to daydream in.
Just briefly, do you have a next project in mind?
I have a couple next projects in mind, and both projects play with form in the same way that Pavilion and that Memphis play with form, in terms of not necessarily documentary, not necessarily fiction, but a hybrid, kind of inhabiting a hybrid space. Telling stories is secondary to me. I'm much more interested in creating cinematic worlds.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Okay. But Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Sure. Great to have you back in Wisconsin.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with director and University of Wisconsin alum Tim Sutton. His film Memphis is screening at the Wisconsin Film Festival tonight at 9 at the Sundance Cinema.